This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal, and I'm Stephen Henderson. I'm here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II. Hey, Carrie.
Good morning, Stephen. How you doing?
I'm great. Today, we get to do something I love to do on the show, and that's talk about a book, right? I'm always reading anyway. Might as well make it part of work. Mm-hmm. And we've got a really great book to talk about today. It's called HBCU Made, A Celebration of the Black College Experience, and it's a collection of stories and essays that were compiled by Ayesha Rasko. She is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday and weekend episodes of Up First. She's also a former White House correspondent and a graduate of Howard University. I know this is a conversation that you are really excited about, Carrie, because you're also an HBCU graduate.
I am a Morehouse graduate. Before I get too far into that, though, I got to mention, Stephen, I don't know about making all of your fun hobbies your job.
I have a real problem with that. Yeah. I'm working on it.
Got to keep them separate.
Right. I like to read, though, and that fits perfectly with the work here.
It does. It is also a conversation that, like you said, I'm looking forward to having. As an HBCU grad, the diversity and variety of that experience is something I think is really, really unique, and I don't think it's thought of that way from the outside. You're thinking, oh, a school with all black people, like I live in a black neighborhood, or maybe I hang out with all black people. I want to expand my horizons, which I think is great. But for me, I expanded my horizons within that group. So I saw way more different types of black folks that I had seen prior to that. I think there's, especially going from U of D, as you know, there's a smaller group of us there, and there's a kind of monolithic perception of how we ought to act, and that completely was broken up in pieces when I went to Morehouse by seeing all the different types of groups.
I think that's an incredible recognition of what's possible and what is likely at an HBCU, and it's not something that I think most people who think about HBCUs necessarily register, that you're going to have this diverse experience, but it is mostly among African Americans. So I'm really excited to talk to Ayesha about her experience and this book that she has put together. So let's get to it.
Get to it.
Ayesha Rasko, welcome to Created Equal.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, it is great to have you with us in Detroit, and great to have you here on the show. So I want to start with an idea that I had after taking a look at your book, the author of this new book, A Celebration of the Black College Experience, a book that you have characterized as a love letter to HBCUs. Is it right to think of this as an answer to the questions that I hear some people asking these days about HBCUs? Questions like, well, why do we need all black colleges or colleges that are based on the idea of educating African Americans? Looking through these essays and these stories really, to me, seems like a forceful way of saying, hey, hold on a second. Here's the reason this is important. Here's the reason this is valuable. Am I right for thinking of it that way?
I think that's a good way to put it. I would say that it's more of a less of a defensive, and it's more of an offensive thing. I think it is more of an affirmative saying, an affirmative response, and really a testimony to say that these institutions have given so much to the world, really, and continue to do so, and that they are worthy of celebration and worthy of support. And I want you to know this. So it's really more, I think of it, because, you know, I'm a little church girl from North Carolina. So I think of it more as a testimony. It's more of letting the world know, in case you didn't know, this is what HBCUs have done for all of these incredible people. But I do agree that in this book, you get get the answers to those questions that you were posing. So in case you were wondering, there are right. answers in here.
In case you didn't know, now you
yes.
know.
Yes, yes.
So do those questions grate on you, though? I mean, as somebody who went to an HBCU and has this great fondness for it, does it bother you when people ask those questions about why we still have them?
They don't really bother me in the sense that because I feel like, I mean, I'm a journalist, so I believe in asking questions, mm-hmm. right? And I believe that you should be able to answer the questions. And so when people start asking those questions, in a way, I get excited because I got answers for you, right?
So for me,
I don't look at it as, I mean, sometimes people can definitely do it in a sense and they're trying to be disrespectful. Sometimes I do think people have legitimate questions. And so, but for me, I think because I'm a journalist, mm-hmm. I don't find questions necessarily offensive, right? Yeah. Like I can answer and I believe in the idea that if you feel strongly about something, you should be able to answer the questions that people have about it. You should be able to explain yourself. And that may be just the reporter in
me. Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about what led you to attend an HBCU. Talk about where you grew up and the community you come from and how that decision came to be the one that made the most sense to you.
Well, you know, I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, but my mother is a proud graduate of Winston-Salem State University, mm-hmm. which is an HBCU, mm-hmm. and my uncle went there. I have a lot of family ties there, and you know, North Carolina has a lot of HBCUs, I believe at least a dozen. Mm-hmm. And so for me growing up in, you know, and in Durham, you have Central, North Carolina Central University. So for me growing up, it was not odd to think about HBCUs and to consider going to an HBCU. For me personally, though, I wanted to get out of North Carolina. I didn't want to stay in North Carolina because I was a very shy kid and didn't have any friends really. And I wanted to be able to just go to a place where no one knew me and I could kind of forge my own path. Mm. And so I wanted to get out of North Carolina. And Howard was a school that had always stood out to me. It was, to me, it was the Mecca. It was this cool place. So many incredible people had gone there. And I felt like, well, wow, like if I go there, maybe I could be somebody too. Maybe I could do something worthwhile as well.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I went. Ended up at Howard.
And when you got there, I mean, Washington, D.C. is a lot different from yes. from Durham. But talk about finding your place, you know, at an HBCU in a city like Washington, which is different than doing it in other places.
It is. I mean, and it was a big change for me. I mean, look, Durham, you know, had, you know, some people could say Durham is rough and tumble. I mean, it was, but it's not D.C.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it wasn't a huge a city the way D.C. is. And so going there, it was a big culture shock, just being in a more urban environment. Learning how to take the train, the metro, you know, just being able, having to be, you know, a little bit streets. I didn't have no street smarts. I had to develop some of that. And then, but also just going to an HBCU, you are exposed to all sorts of people, right? Like this idea that you don't have diversity of people in an HBCU.
Yeah.
It's not really true. Like you meet all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds. And so I had to, you know, I'm meeting people who are very different from me, have very different values, do very different things. And I'm kind of trying to figure out, okay, so what do I want to do and who do I want to be? And I'm doing that in a sense where I want to be liked and I'm a people pleaser and I, you know, all those things, I think that come along with being you know, with being a young adult. And so a lot of bumps and bruises and, you know, things that were difficult and hard and tears, cried and all of that, you know, that comes with it. But doing it in this space where there really did feel like there was a community, and doing it in a place where I could see myself, right, and in others, not, you know, not literally we look alike, but like, you know, this idea that I could see people who look like me, and I didn't have to constantly be thinking about, you know, or defending the reason why I was there, or defending, you know, like yes, I'm smart, yes, I got in, you know, not having to deal with that sort of thing.
So that point you made earlier about the diversity of people that you find at an HBCU, I think is really important, and it's something that people who don't attend or not part of the Black community might not really quite grasp this idea of the diversity of Black people, right? There are all kinds of different Black people with all kinds of experiences and from all kinds of places. And we're not all alike. We don't all think alike. We don't all enjoy the same things. We don't all have the same experiences. And an HBCU is a place where you can see that in a way that that maybe is different from other parts in our society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just like, you know, if you go to a school that's predominantly white, no one would look at that school and say, well, I guess everybody's the same here, huh?
Right.
But it's the same thing at an HBCU. But at an HBCU, and you know, many essays in the book talk about this. I think Lauren F. Ellis, she's like a visual effects producer. So all the big movies that you see, like Aquaman and stuff, she's worked on. She went to Hampton and she talked like really beautifully about, you know, just the first week there, like they did these kind of call and responses at this pep rally. And you had all of these people, you know, claiming, you know, their homes, which were, you know, everywhere from Jamaica to Guyana to Nigeria to so all over the world. Right. Like you had all these Black people from all over the world, you know, all over the country, because, you know, someone from Chicago is not the same as someone from Alabama, is not the same as someone from Oakland. And so, you know, she talks about kind of seeing that diversity for herself. And even though she had grown up in, you know, predominantly, you know, Black spaces or spaces with a lot of Black people, even for her, like seeing all of that really, you know, sealed for her the diversity of the Black experience.
Yeah.
And then also she talks about, you know, I think on her first day running into her first Black Republican. And so, you know, you right, have all sorts
Black
of
Black Republicans on HBCU campuses. Shocker.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, just it's so there's all sorts of so this idea that to go to an HBCU is to miss out on diversity, I think is absolutely not true.
Yeah. So you were talking about being a shy kid and kind of seeking a new experience. Where did you find yourself landing at Howard? What was your click, and what kind of things did you find yourself interested in, other than journalism, of course? But
Well, I mean, journalism did end up being my click because I started working for the school newspaper, and that really became my life.
Yes.
And everything that, you know, the hilltop. I think also outside of that, you know, I had we had like suites then. So, you know, we had our dorm rooms, but then, you know, it'd be like three dorm rooms and then you'd share a bathroom. So we had our suite. So I had my suite mates and my roommates who I was hanging out. You know, when I wasn't doing like working for the school newspaper, I was with my best friends, Dallas and Keisha, and we were watching a lot of Law and Order, all the different iterations of Law and Order. You know, we were spending late nights going to McDonald's. There was a 24-hour McDonald's near campus. We didn't have back then, the area around Howard had not been gentrified.
Yeah, it was really different, right?
Yeah, it was very different. And so basically what we had was the 24-hour McDonald's, and we had some Chinese spots. And that was about it. And, like, so, you know, if it was late at night, and we're college students. So late at night, it could be a snowstorm. I remember a big snowstorm, and for some reason, we decided we had to walk to McDonald's in the snowstorm. I remember, you know, us falling in the snow, trying to get to McDonald's to get some, I don't know, get some French fries, some chicken nuggets or something. But yeah, like that's the sort of stuff I was doing. And watching horror movies, which I always loved. Yeah, So yeah, so that's the stuff. I was doing that, and I was doing the Hilltop. Like, yeah. I was doing the new school newspaper. That's what I was doing.
I always say there is nothing like the college journalism experience. It becomes everything. It is like a fraternity or a sorority or almost like playing a sport, right?
Absolutely.
It's all day, every day.
And at one point, my junior and senior year, we were daily. And so it was a really, you know, we really didn't have the resources to do that, but we did it. And it was just, it was all consuming. It was, you know, late hours. It was all, you know, just trying to get the paper out.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Ayesha Rascoe. She is host of Weekend Edition Sunday and Up First Saturdays on NPR. And she's author of HBCU Made, a celebration of the Black college experience. And we'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson. Our guest today is Ayesha Rascoe. She's a former White House correspondent, a graduate of Howard University, and author of a book titled HBCU Made, A Celebration of the Black College Experience. Ayesha, I want to talk about the book and how you decided to write it and how you decided to include these stories from other people in it. How did you pick them? And what were you thinking about when you put together this roster of other storytellers?
You know, so Algonquin, the publisher of the book, you know, came to me with this idea, and they said, you know, would you want to put together a collection of essays about HBCUs, you know, and have HBCU graduates in their own words talk about their experience and why it mattered so much to them. And the thing that they said to me that really stood out was that this hadn't been done before. And that was a shocker to me, because this seems like a no-brainer. Yeah. And then, like, I couldn't believe that this had not been done. And so, you know, I thought about it a little bit, but I couldn't let it go. And I decided to become the author and the editor of this, and to go out and ask all these people to write essays, and to beg and, you know, plead and to get the net, which is a lot. You know, it's a lot to ask busy and successful people to write, you know, 3,000 words about their experience. But what I was looking for was people, you know, both known and unknown, who could talk about how the HBCU experience, how it was unique, and how it set them on a path, and what that meant to them. And I felt like, you know, it was really important to me to get a wide range of contributors. So, you know, from people who are a little more seasoned to people who are, you know, just starting out, like Brandon Gilpin, an actor. He's the youngest person in the book. He just graduated from Morehouse in 2021. Mm. So I wanted, you know, different generations. And then it was also very, very important to me that I get, you know, a wide range of institutions represented, because there are 100 HBCUs in the country, in the U.S. And so, you know, it's not just the Howards and the Morehouses. You know, there are a lot of HBCUs that get less attention. A lot of them are smaller. And so I wanted to get, you know, the Talladegas and the, you know, the Morgan States, and Dillard's. So I wanted them to be represented as well. So that was also a part of, you know, the what I was looking for and seeking in these essays.
Yeah. The book also includes lots of information that puts HBCUs in the kind of context of inequality and challenges that we have with higher ed in the country, and of course with race. Why was it important for you to include things like discussion of the lack of support for LGBTQ students, for instance, or the financial struggles that we still see at lots of HBCUs?
Well, I think going back to, like, as a reporter, like, for me, I never wanted this book to just be PR mm-hmm. or to be fluff. I always knew that it would include things that might not put HBCUs in the best light, because I feel like, and you know, when I was pitching this to people, I would say, you know, I do look at this as a love letter, but love is complicated. Mm. And love is not, you know, love is challenging. And sometimes loving something means challenging it to be the best that it can possibly be. And so it was important to me to have, you know, Michael Arsenault, who is a New York Times bestselling author, has a new book coming out in March. So make sure you get it. Mm-hmm. It was important to me to have his essay as a gay Black man who wasn't out at Howard and eventually did come out, but wasn't out when he first started at Howard, and talking about his experience and to talk about how, you know, there were attacks on gay students at, you know, Howard and other HBCUs, and how that affected him. And, you know, how there was still a lot of room to grow in having universities accept and love and embrace these Black people who yeah. are also who are Black people, but also have these other identities. Right. And he basically said that he wanted Howard to love him as much as he loved it. And I think that that was important. I think that was really important to have and to talk about in this book.
Do you see through lines in the essays, other than, of course, this reverence and love for the institutions where, you know, people attended school? Are there other things that kind of bind the essays together in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, I always say there's community. You know, you see throughout the essays where people really talk about how not only did they develop their own communities there, but that they, you know, you have these professors and other people who really poured into, you know, the contributors, and they talk about how what that meant to them. Tendai Kumba at Spelman, a Broadway dancer and singer, who got into a bad accident at Spelman and didn't know if she was going to dance again, and her Spelman community really rallied around her. And now she's, you know, on Broadway. And so I think that sort of community, yeah. another, you know, the talking about diversity, also a lot of just the fun, like there's a lot of fun at, HBCUs. Another thing that's come up, and I think, is, you know, people are even talking about now, is A Different World. I mean, that show,
yeah.
and they're having a reunion now, and they're going to HBCUs in Atlanta and talking about the importance of HBCUs. But like in this book, so many of the essays talked about the impact of A Different World yeah. and how they, you know, how that just made them want to go to an HBCU, and how that, you know, how that encouraged them and all this stuff. And so you know, to the point where it's some of the essays I just couldn't even include it because I said, at this point,
it's just repetitive.
We've had it enough. But I just think that when you look at it now, like I said, they're doing a reunion. I mean, it's just incredible how much that piece of pop culture, like, really had an impact on people.
Yeah.
And continues to have an impact to this day. But I also think that it speaks to how the HBCU experience and the culture of the HBCU experience is so dynamic and could touch people back then and touch people to today.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about A Different World, which premiered when I was, I think, 11 or 12, and the impact that it's had on HBCUs. Well, you know, one of the things that was really great about that show, I thought, was that, it grows out of the Cosby Show. And that's an upper middle class family with two, you know, highly professional parents and all kinds of resources and success and things. And, you know, I do remember friends of mine, white friends of mine, saying when that show, when A Different World started, that they were kind of surprised at the emphasis on an HBCU by a family like the family that was depicted, you know, on the Cosby Show. And I was like, well, you know, lots of people, lots of people go to HBCUs. It's not for one type of black family. The history is all across African American life. And I don't think people really, I do think there were a lot of people who didn't know that before that show. Yeah.
And didn't know, I think that show really depicts how not only that, but that HBCUs provided this pathway
Absolutely.
For highly successful black people because they were shut out of these other institutions. And so they would go to HBCUs and then become very famous. And that's why Whitley Gilbert's family named the dorm
that's
and all
right.
that. Like, because you would have these, you know, and that there were these legacies. So you had these very upper crust, you know, black people, and you still see this today, you know, people who, you know, some are at Martha's Vineyard and are very, who have, you know, very long histories of going to HBCUs because HBCUs provided education to that very high level of, you know, black people and black achievement. But then you also had, and depicted on that show, the people who were kind of just getting in,
just
first
getting by.
In their generation to go. You know, maybe their grades weren't that great. Family doesn't have money like that. So you saw the range of it, like that not everybody came. So, yeah, you had the kind of rich upper class, like the Whitley Gilberts, but then you had the more working class, like Kimberly Reese and all of that, you know, like, so you had like the, and then, you know, later on, of course, you would have Jada Pinkett's Smith's character who was just like getting in by the seat of her teeth, right? Like, I mean, I just think that you, but I think that is really true to the HBCU experience, where you have many, many students who are there who are first generation. You have many students there that are Pell Grant recipients. But you do also have these legacy students, these students who come from generations of people, of black people who have gone to these HBCUs and are very proud, you know, graduates of these HBCUs that accepted them and embraced them when these other schools would not.
I want to talk about after college for you in particular and what it's meant to be a Howard graduate, both in positive ways and maybe in some challenging ways. What do people think of where you went to school and in the world where you operate now in journalism and in Washington? What's the way that Howard kind of plays a role, I guess, in your life now?
Well, you know, I got my very first job at Reuters, and this was a job that I was at for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So really set the foundation for my journalism career because of Howard. They had a business reporting class where they partnered with Reuters, and I was in the class, and that's how, you know, people at Reuters became familiar with my work. I will say that it kind of depends on the time period. The time period when I was coming out, say for instance, a lot of the internship programs, especially for kind of like, you know, the Reuters and the Bloombergs and the big ones, they generally would have students from all the Ivy Leagues, from Harvard, Columbia grad school, you know, Yale, you know, maybe mm-hmm. Mizzou.
Yeah.
Maybe they do a state school like Mizzou, which is known for, you know, journalism and things like that. But not necessarily Howard. I think that has changed now. Mm. I think because there's a push for diversity. So a lot of institutions will have, you know, maybe special partnerships with HBCUs. So I think it kind of ebbs and flows. But at that time, there were not like a lot of people from Howard who were in the internship program. I was the only one.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about what year that is, though. I mean,
that was 2007.
Yeah. So this, we're not talking about 30, 40 years ago. We're talking just a decade and a half ago had these barriers for people from places like Howard.
Yeah, you know, and I think after they got me, they did get another, my good friend, who became my good friend, they did get some more Howard people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's part of the, so I think that, you know, when you look at the challenges, I think there are times when if you're not going to these certain schools,
right,
these certain Ivy Leagues, you may not be at the front of the line. But I will say, like I said, I think that in many ways, with the emphasis on diversity and the emphasis on trying to reach out, you do have a lot of companies now that go to HBCU specifically
looking for talent,
to look for people. But that, all of that can be based on kind of ebbs and flows. But I will say that going to Howard, you know, it was the best decision for me. And it really, like I said, it's how I got my first job. And really, in reality, like, you know, when I tell people I went to Howard, people are always like, oh, wow. Like, I mean, I think that there is like an acknowledgement of it. And there's a respect for it. I do believe that. And I do think there's a camaraderie, too, among other people who went to HBCUs. And it doesn't have to be your HBCU, right? Like, I think that people, like, there is a community and a connection for HBCU graduates, whether they went to, you know, whether they went to the same HBCU or not. So April Ryan, who's in the book and is a legendary, you know, White House correspondent, she went to Morgan State and is a good friend of mine. So I think that it's, you know, I think that you can have a camaraderie, you know, even just among HBCU grads.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Aisha Rasko of NPR about her book, HBCU Made. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and today we're talking with Aisha Rasko. She is the host of Weekend Edition Sunday and Up for Saturdays on NPR. She's a former White House correspondent, a Howard University graduate, and author of a book titled HBCU Made, a celebration of the Black college experience. Aisha, I want to talk about some things that are going on now with HBCUs, and they're good things, right? The enrollment, visibility, increasing support, You were talking about how things seem to be changing in journalism in terms of opportunity for graduates of HBCUs. But there's something about this particular political climate, I think, that has kind of opened up more interest in HBCUs and in some ways more support. I mean, that comes, of course, with the tension of backlash and things like that, which we see. But I get the sense that that things are going pretty strongly in the right direction to deal with some of the challenges that HBCUs have had for a while.
I do think that it is a mixed bag because you do have so many HBCUs and not all of them are getting the same amount of attention. But I do think that you do see this absolutely, you know, very clear resurgence of interest and support for HBCUs. You know, Spelman just got $100 million.
Largest gift ever.
That's incredible. You also, there was a huge gift, I believe around $100 million, to the organization that really supports all HBCUs. That money will be divided up among HBCUs. And, you know, even, you know, talking about Spelman, you know, I did during my book tour, you know, we had Dr. Beverly Tatum, who was, you know, president of Spelman College previously. And she talked about how I think normally they get maybe like 3,000 applications for maybe like 500 spots. And she said recently maybe they got 15,000 applications.
Wow.
And ended up having a freshman class at Spelman of like 700. So I think, you know, the interest and the applications is definitely, it is there after the racial reckoning, after the murder of George Floyd. You know, really, you know, the whole Trump administration, like there was a lot of talk about investing. And I say, you know, during the Trump administration with all the, you know, protests and this and that and the third, but there was a lot of talk about race and there was talk about investing in Black institutions and, you know, why are we sending our, you know, athletes and, you know, best talent? Why are you going to these schools, these white schools, you know, quote unquote, when you could send them to HBCUs?
Sure.
I also think, you know, Beyonce, Beachella, and now, you know, her homecoming album, you know, there was just a lot of attention in pop culture on its shows. And then, you know, ultimately you also have the first, vice president, first woman vice president of the United States, who is an HBCU graduate,
That's right.
Who went to Howard University. I think that really, you know, for people who will question whether you can really rise in society with an HBCU degree, whether there are limitations on that. I think that, you know, seeing Kamala Harris, however you may feel about her politically, I think seeing her in this space answers that question that, yes, you can rise to the highest of high ranks going to an HBCU and that it doesn't have to, you know, this idea that it holds you back. I think that, you know, her place really kind of calls that and shows that to not be true.
No, it really does. So I want to ask you about that same dynamic, though. I mean, you're working at NPR in Washington. You were a White House correspondent. Now you're hosting the weekend shows. So 20 years ago, a little more than 20 years ago, I was a journalist in Washington. I was assigned to cover the Supreme Court, actually the first African-American assigned to cover the court full time for Knight Ritter newspapers, which I did for five terms. And one of the things that I really remember starkly, I mean, I had wonderful memories about the work and the time that I was there. And of course, it was this incredible experience. But I also remember how white official Washington is and was, not just in terms of elected officials and appointees and people like that, but in terms of journalism. The fact that I was the first African-American assigned to cover the Supreme Court in 2003, you know, almost 35 years, really, after the first Black Supreme Court justice had been appointed, right? Thurgood Marshall's in the 60s. And so I remember what that felt like, right? Day after day in that courtroom, often sitting there, and, you know, it was me and Clarence Thomas. there's no other Black folks in there, right? And how that felt different from where I was from here in Detroit and some of my other experiences. So I wonder for you now, 20 years later, what does that look like? And how does that feel? Is it the same as it was? Is it better? Do you get those? Do you have those moments where you're like, I'm here and maybe kind of by myself?
I would definitely say throughout my time, you know, in DC, which has been my whole career in covering energy and policy, you know, and Congress, and the White House, there were definitely times and many times when I was the only one, or one of the only ones, who was, a person of color at all, and definitely the only Black woman. And so that absolutely is still there. I do think that it has, I don't want to say that it hasn't gotten better, because I do believe so. I mean, at the White House, there were, I was not the only Black, woman at the White House. Like there were definitely, there was a group of us. Now during the Trump administration, everybody got called out, but we were there. I do think it's better, but it is, there's still a long way to go. So I want to acknowledge that I think that, that you do see more Black women and Black men, but not always as many Black men.
Yeah.
And that's the truth.
That's a thing in journalism, right?
Yeah. And then, but you do see more, but it still is, overwhelmingly white. Like, that's just the fact, running around in Congress. And I think that it does have an impact. Even in sourcing and stuff like that, we don't talk about it that much, but it is a difference when you're trying to talk to, the staffers or what have you, and you didn't go to the same schools, and you don't live in the same neighborhoods, and you don't have this. We don't really talk about that much, but it is, I have heard that pretty much from every, Black journalist that I've ever talked to, that there is a difference. And people don't, because we're all just taught like we're going to do our jobs. I think nobody wants to complain about it, but that there is a reality there that, there are some that the connections that some people have are not as easily available.
Yeah. So what about in your current roles? You're breaking new ground as the voice of NPR on weekend mornings. I mean, the number of people who turn to that, as a touchstone for their week, right, to hear what's going on the weekends is huge. This is the first time they're hearing a Black woman explain the world to them.
They've definitely been other Black women, maybe not Black Southern, with my accent. Right. But there are other, I want to give
Michelle Norris.
Michelle Martin is a legend.
Michelle Martin, right.
And, Artie Cornish, I think very briefly did. So I want to be very clear on that. There have been very amazing Black journalists and Black women at NPR and continue to be.
Yeah.
But no, I think there is a difference.
It's every week with you.
Every week, that people notice. With my dialect, the way I sound a bit different, and that my this idea of a Black dialect, which is mm-hmm. real and people study mm-hmm. it, that I probably have a little bit more of it than people are used to hearing on the radio. Or that's what John McWhorter, the New York Times columnist,
sure.
said.
Yeah, right.
So, I sound different. Like, I do. I sound different.
It sounds Southern to me.
Yes, it sounds Southern, yeah.
So but I think to white people,
it
sounds more Black, right.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a mix. I think it's a mix of the Southernness and the Blackness. You know, my name's Aisha. They know right. there's something going on here.
Yeah, right.
That they're not used to hearing. And so it is a difference. And I think that what I have tried to do, I mean, what I hope is that it will be less stark in the future mm-hmm. and that you will hear all sorts of dialects and all sorts of accents and that you'll allow people to, you know, tell the news, because it really doesn't make a difference, right? People understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
They understand what I'm talking about. And I think it does expand the idea of what authority has to sound like. And, you know, as we're also trying to expand the idea of what authority looks like. And I think, you know, all of those things kind of go together. Like, people should be able to be their authentic selves.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with their ability to do their job or their professionalism or their talent or intelligence. And they shouldn't have to strip all of that off, to be acceptable, and to sound like a certain way. So
yeah.
So I think, I hope that's part of what is happening with me and hopefully there will be more and others who will do that as well.
Yeah. And the preparation that you got for that at Howard, I would imagine, has
yeah.
a lot to do with your ability to just kind of go in and do the job and not worry about a lot of the rest of it, right? This kind of strength
yeah.
and confidence that I think going to an HBCU helps instill in people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it provided me with a context and an understanding of why this is not really about me, that
right.
this is, you
wow.
know, that this is, that there is this larger thing at play, that's not really about Aisha Roscoe. It's about people not being used to hearing a Black woman, a Southern Black woman, telling them about the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, so I think that is, you know, so it gave me that. And it also gave me the confidence of seeing so many, you know, Black people thriving and doing amazing and incredible things and understanding and seeing that they're from all over the world and talk and sound all sorts of ways, to understand that, you know, authority doesn't have to look one way. It doesn't have to be one way. And so that's part of what
that word yes. authority is so important. Not just in journalism, but in our culture, right? Who has the foundation? Who has the power to speak to others and to speak yeah. for others, right?
To be listened to.
And to be listened to, right?
Yeah. So I think that, yeah, I think it's important, and I think it's I think that definitely going to an HBCU, going to Howard, it gave me that foundation to be able to deal with, you know, the criticisms, but then also to understand, you know, the larger picture.
Yeah. Okay. Before I let you go, tell me your favorite essay. I know that's not fair. You got to pick among your children here.
They're all my babies.
Yeah.
So I don't have a favorite, but what I will highlight the one that, you know, people always talk about, and that's Roy Wood Jr.
Yeah, I loved that one.
Yes, he's a comedian, and he went to FAMU. And he talked about, you know, how he basically got a second chance because he got into really bad trouble, really serious
yeah.
trouble, and got suspended. and it was FAMU that gave him a second chance. Yeah. And so that story, I think, is a story that everybody loves and that, you know, that, yeah. that people always talk about.
And he was the first person.
Is written in his voice. And he was the first person to say yes to doing the book and the first essay in. So wow. I will always be forever grateful.
Yeah, no, that's Woody fair. Jr. That's fair. Yeah. mine is hands down Stacey Abrams, who
is beautiful.
Just one of my favorite people, yeah. right? Yeah. I just think the mind at work there is so incredible. And her essay about her time at Spelman was just spellbinding. So that was my favorite. Yeah. All right. Well, Ayesha Roscoe, it was really great having you here with us on Created Equal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.